why would I need to modify something to increase our chance to really succeed is really the thing. Okay? All right, guys, we're going to go to 11:30 and everything, but again, we'll continue on with some of the...
Just a second, okay. Gary. The operator on this, speaking of learning curve and risk reward and all of that, has been a lot of difficulty.
All right, guys. We'll continue on with some more examples. Again, Pastor Abraham, he's standing out at the school, but we would have just never had the opportunity had we not had that fluke opportunity to meet him. You know, it's just incredible. This is the lady I was telling you about, Nancy Ball. She went to Ghana in 1966. And she joined up with this lady. She's from Pennsylvania. And she has four little churches that were supporting her up in Pennsylvania and continue even to this day to support this ministry as best they can. But these two ladies, can you imagine, they're in northern Ghana, living in the villages to start with, and they started a literacy work where they would just go to one village after another, but their whole goal was someday that a Bible would be printed in the Wali language. That's the native dialect in northern Ghana. So they had this dream, and as they started to work with these people, and then they put together actually a Bible school, and they just began to grow on itself. But unknowingly, through their efforts, they were creating an infrastructure in northern Ghana with people that can read and write. And when they first arrived, 98% of people in northern Ghana were totally illiterate. Today, it's actually down to 78%. It's getting better and better, but it's still pretty bad. So this whole idea of their literacy work has really been amazing. When you see Paul Abraham here on the left, he's like you. He's an anchor as far as in his community. He's a pastor, and he was one of the first teachers, and David was there to help him, and they kept these literacy classes going because both of those ladies had family health issues. Their parents got sick. They had to come home for a few years, and then they went back. But the whole time they were gone, they had taught these men how to keep it going. And that was the initial startup of this work in northern Ghana. As it proceeded on, then Isaac learned through the school there that they had put together to do things, and then Jacob's the same way, and their literacy team teachers also. Isaac's a unique story in that he's got a mind for numbers in addition. So I had our church financial officer go over with me, and he actually set up an Excel program. Isaac uploads every ounce of financial data because I'll tell you, when it comes to doing board work related to missions, one of the biggest things you hear all over the country where I speak, people are concerned about accountability. How do you know where the money's spent? How do you know what's happening? So we taught Isaac in the basic fundamentals of the, and I'll show you an example after lunch, of actually working in Excel, and every month we get a report that's laid out in Excel. We know exactly how much money went for salaries. We know what went to vehicle maintenance. We know what went to the projects. But every ounce of that money is accounted for. So whenever you got somebody that says, hey, I'm willing to give you $50,000, you can say, let me show you how the money's tracked. Shouldn't be an issue, but I'm just letting you know, it's better to get started on the right foot. Because if you are, and again, not because of lack of trust, there's none of that exists. No. But again, if you learn and you set the accountability, if they're helping you, then you have a legitimate concern that you can demonstrate and you can say to the people that report to you of how the money is handled. That credibility becomes important. And not to be unkind, but there is an entire stigma in America related to Nigeria because of the lack of trust that's related to some of the culture there. So that's just one thing that's a more serious issue for you to cope with than a Ghanaian would cope with. Okay?
I think that stigma goes to South America, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of issues. Venezuela.
Yeah, then we are number one.
What was interesting is when they first started, these missionaries raised the funds to buy bicycles. They were walking as far as they could get on any given day, and they were moving from village to village to village. Well, several years ago, they got bikes, and then we were able to raise the funds to buy motorcycles. But of course, you got to have fuel, you got to have insurance, all the other expenses. But now we're ranging a lot further out than what we can do. So it was worth it, but this was the initial start. And as we begin to range and go further out, when I came back from Ghana last March, I shared a concern. I said, you know, the guys are just wearing these motorcycles out. They're going so far, the roads are in terrible condition. So I had no idea. But a lady over in Alabama had heard about what we were doing through a family member that's in our church. She said, look, you know, I'm not much interested. This literacy thing has really got my attention. I'm not looking to build a church. But what I would like to do is try to help keep this literacy program now that the missionary is retired. I know typically the funding slows down. So what I'd like to do is make a significant gift that keeps this literacy program going, but I'd like part of it to be used to improve the life of the pastors and the literacy workers. Mm-hmm. So she gifted $50,000. So we took $30,000 of it and set it up so that up to $500 a month, if the missionary's funding that supports this work, Nancy Ball, who's now in Florida, had a shortfall, we could take up to $500 out of this $30,000 to supplement it, to keep the gap closed, you might say. Mm-hmm. And then our church committed to close the gap on the balance until we could stabilize everything. Then we put $20,000 out to be able to purchase motorcycles, as well as maintenance, all the copying equipment, all the equipment it takes to run the literacy center, and to maintenance things to keep it up and running. So, again, I had no idea. I never asked for that. But you just don't know sometimes if you're just diligent, share your story, mm-hmm. and share what you're doing, then who knows what the Lord may provide.
You bought those in country?
I actually bought those in country. I went over and shopped them because what had happened in the last few years, the Koreans and the Chinese have brought a lot more items into the country than were even ever available before. Did a lot of research on them. These are actually very good machines, and they will probably last at least 3.5 to 4 years.
Those are Korean?
Those are Korean. Chinese. Korean. Koreans have a little better survivability rate. It's not that the Chinese are even bad, but they just had a little longer life cycle on them. So again, these are the things you just don't want to assume. This is a literacy center that we actually built. Now, the people do not come here to learn to read and write. This is where all the materials are produced that they use. So there's big conference tables, there's computers in that thing, there's copy machines, laminate machines. Everything they need to produce training materials is done right here.
How do you get your electricity there?
There's actually power to this facility. There's a broadband connection on this facility. Very unusual to have something like that. But again, we made sure that we could put information back and forth.
So the power is consistent.
It's there, and it's pretty right. consistent here. It still goes down at times, just like most of the countries. But
hey, see why? Where is the power consistent?
In Nigeria.
In Nigeria.
It's not consistent.
The best way to take advantage of that would be get solar.
Yeah,
solar.
Yeah, exactly. And we actually, there's a clinic that's similar to this facility in further north in Ghana that actually is on solar panels. And of course, I'm into that kind of stuff. But But it literally, that thing with those solar panels up there, they had a battery bank in there. They had cigarette lighters built into the tables, so the laptops and all the medical equipment just plugged right in to those things. It was pretty neat. It's just a matter of being a little creative. But for example, this is the guys actually in the literacy center, but they have all the shelving. So like I said, they've got training primers. Everything is there for every category for them to learn and promote these literacy projects. And this was one of the classes I attended while I was over last year. What was really neat is now we're seeing about 70% of our literacy classes are made up of women, where before, when it initially started, it was primarily men because women were working in the field. So what they do is they focus on these classes from January to April during the dry season when people aren't farming. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the men in the north go south to work in the mines. So that obviously pulls a fair amount of the population out of the northern area. And then as they gravitate back, the farming starts. So you tend to get a lot more females now, but it's really impressive to see them. And you can see Paul there actually using flashcards, laminated flashcards, to work with them.
In this setting here, of course, you're saying it's the dry season, so there will be no rain for them sitting in the open.
That's correct. What it is, this is actually a village up in the north that they had just built this new public school, but the local, like, mayor chief of that village, because he was so wanting the literacy for his people, he gave access to the public school building for them to use it. But what's interesting here, and I'm not sure how it is in Nigeria, but you're so far north. You're only about 100 miles off the lower edge of the Sahara Desert. But I'm on this village, and I'm standing out a little ways, and I'm actually got photographs where you see, and I think they call, is it the Hamatan winds.
Yeah.
You see that thing blowing in, it's like a fog, but it's micro dust coming off the deserts, and it is a brown fog just rolls over you in there. It's absolutely mind-boggling to see this thing. But yeah, it's just cooler. But obviously, if for some reason they were to get a rain shower, they could get inside. But they just let them bring the benches out because it's cooler. Because at that time of the year, it's typically running about 110 to 120 degrees.
No, I mean, I'm thinking of the impact of the literacy program as far as coming back to assess the result in the believer's life, say, if they have become a believer. Because unlike here, that we can go back and pick up our Bibles and read, over there, outside what is heard and internalized, there's no further reference to the
these people,
hard copy.
These people have, in May of 2010, they have a complete Bible in the Wali language. It's an incredible thing in their church services to be part of it, because as the pastors are working through the sermons, they'll call out and see that congregation, those people reading back.
Okay.
And what they do, for example, I was at a church last week giving a presentation that had been instrumental in helping with the development and printing of this Bible. There are literally thousands of Bibles stored there because the people are so poor, they can't even buy them. And so what they do, though, in order to make sure that they take ownership of it, they create a scholarship program. So if people learn so many verses and various things they can participate, then they can earn a Bible. And that becomes their most treasured possession, is the ownership of that Bible in their own language. Absolutely. But that was one of the major reasons for the vision of these ladies thing, was to get them eventually so they could read and study themselves and not only hear it.
Yes.
Absolutely. These are churches that have been built. Zambogo was the first one to go up. That is a substantial. This was just a mud little building to begin with. And one of our teams, construction teams, went over to help get the foundations and the major part of the roof and that on. Then they finished it. Topco was the next one that went up in similar thing. And this is the one that's really interesting to me, because this is Kanwengashi. And This one was finished about 2 years ago, but I had gone over on a trip 3 years back. And they take me out there, and funds had been given to build this church, but it wasn't finished. So when I got out there, I said, Pastor Paul, what happened? Why didn't it get finished? He said, well, Brother Gary, it's just a mistake. And he said, but let me share the story with you. He said, this building was supposed to be X feet by X feet. He said, I personally came out of here, staked it off, but I couldn't stay. So I instructed our guys, local guys that were building it, to dig the foundations and what to do and what all they should get handled. Well, lo and behold, they took it on themselves after they got to looking at the strings pulled and all that. And they said, this thing's too small. We're just going to spread these out a little bit, make it a little bigger. But they didn't realize he had calculated on the square foot how much money he had. So they stretched them strings out about another 30 feet and all that stuff and start building. And he's going along and they're calling for money and he's sending money to them. And he says, where are you guys at? You don't have windows, doors. You don't have a floor poured. We're going to run out of money. So he goes back up there, and lo and behold, he realized, and they said, yeah, we just made it a little bigger. Well, they made it a lot bigger. And so in any case, I looked at it, and I said, well, you know, we need to get this done, so let me get back to the United States and see what I can do. Well, sure enough, I got back and explained the story to a number of people in our congregation and some other churches, and the money came in to finish it. So sent the money over. They finished the building. The very first Sunday, it was at full capacity.
Yes.
So if it had not been that mistake made and slowed it down and went ahead and got it bigger, it would have never been able to meet the needs of the local community.
As you were talking, I was just saying, if we didn't make that mistake, then we need to pray in the soul to build up. And now you're confident. It just has God what happened.
That's right. Exactly. So you just don't know why things happen sometimes. Yeah. This is the literacy work. All this literacy work started right here in Wah. This is a major hub in northwestern Ghana. But all of the red buildings are actually full-blown constructed churches. These little ones are actually fellowships and villages where this church started another literacy work here. And the literacy team actually travels all throughout there, and they actually have paid teachers for that 4 months out of the year. They live in the villages with the people, training and working with them, developing relationships. And then all of a sudden, as the literacy work's going on, it opens an opportunity of witness. So then you have this thing just building on itself. And the literacy work is completely open to anyone, Muslim, Christian, non-believer, anything. So there's no limitations to provide literacy. But I think that gives you a quick example over what was done over all these years and why we have the infrastructure that we do. And this is going to be important in a minute, so just kind of embed that map in your mind a little there. Tell you another interesting story about this Bible getting translated. This young man, when he was 16 years old, he got some type of bacterial disease, and it paralyzed him from about the center of his back down. And the gentleman that was translating the Bible, he had gotten most of the New Testament done. He died. All of a sudden, he passed away. So thinking, oh man, what are we going to do? You know, Pastor Paul is pretty good at translating. But, you know, understanding English perfectly to get the semicolons and the commas and all that in the right spot and make the enunciation correct. Well, Hamidou is his name. Hamidou paralyzed in a bed. Nancy happened to come home for a mission trip or a furlough back here. And she said, Hamidou's he's brilliant. He understands the English language better than anybody over there, and I think he can translate. He's trying to help us, but we're doing everything manually. So I said, tell you what, Nancy, before you leave to go home, Deborah and I will take you to lunch. We're going to go to a couple of computer stores, and we want to get you a new computer, a new laptop, and we want you to take Hamidou a laptop. We need something he can just get right in front of him on the table and work from. So sure enough, we get this laptop over there. Not only does he finish the New Testament, he completely translates the Old Testament.
All that one guy?
All from laying on his back, yes. And of course, he used Pastor Paul and the others listening to kind of proof it all, but he drove the whole translation as Wally Language Bible.
That's phenomenal.
It's unbelievable.
How long did it take him?
A couple of years. And what was interesting is they took and they would print out each book of the Bible as they got it. And they'd bind it, you know, in a regular binder. They literally, to start with, as they were building this Bible, they had these desks made for each church. Each one of those churches that you saw had a desk. It's about yay long, about big as this table at least, maybe a little longer. Had a set of drawers on each side. They could work at it, but every drawer had a compartment built in it, and it took that whole desk to house one Bible. Because they were all in their individual printed books. And of course, when it finished, we had a traditional Bible like we would be used to. But they kept adding. Every time they could get one published, they'd send it to the churches. And this is just a picture where Isaac is actually translating for me. And I was over doing one of the financial training programs. And my typical class size when I'm over there doing that part of it is typically anywhere from about 15, and I've had up to 45 at times. And what's been encouraging is really about half and half men and women in the bigger classes. And we do try our best because a lot of the women now, especially that run their little stands and things, it doesn't matter what it is. But part of the thing is we talked about yesterday, that's really key, and we'll get into this afternoon, is the whole concept of if I've been living in survival mode all my life, and I'm living day to day, week to week at best, it becomes challenging for me to be able to think forward, where will I be a year from now? Where will I be 5 years if I do this, if I do this? One of the biggest things I've run into also in this type of training is literally not understanding the true cost of doing anything. Because again, it's what I call a results-oriented thinking process where if I do this, what are the results I will achieve? But what will it take as a combination of all of these small things to get to this result? Well, it's like raising up a sheep herd. It's astounding the fact that they traditionally would not take the cost of the food they had to buy for an animal as the part of the cost of what that animal took to raise it up. So they really just didn't understand medicine. I said, do you have something in your budget for a veterinary bill? No. Wouldn't you want to allocate something for that? Well, what about a medicine or vaccination? Oh, okay, yeah. Well, what about the supplement? You're going to grow the corn, that's fine. But what about the supplement that you've got to put with it? Oh, yeah. You know, in other words, it's that kind of thing. It's just that step by step. And we'll talk about those, but it's going to be very important for you CY as we come through. I'm just trying not to leave anything out that I've run into, okay? This is one of the things we were talking about yesterday. I just wanted to show you guys. We were talking about the difference between relief to rehabilitation to development. Even though we have an incredibly developed mission work over there, it is truly in developmental mode. But Pastor Isaac here, and his family, they were living on the mission compound, had been for years because he took care of all the maintenance, kept the well running, the power going, all that stuff. But they're converting that compound into a Bible college. So they had notified us, and not out of any want to create hardship, but say, hey, the house that Isaac's been living in, we're going to end up needing that because we're going to be bringing in more students to go to Bible college. So it was going to take him out of a place to live. Well, He had given up his original home in his village 20 miles out years ago to come live there. Two reasons. One, to keep the compound up and running, but also because the two older ladies living there, they didn't have any other men there to really help keep the place maintenance. So anyway, this is why I came back from a trip and I shared the story. I said, folks, we have got to do something. So this became a relief effort for us. So basically in 10 months, he had this house built. Of course, it was still being painted at this point. But this is a substantial structure. Three bedrooms, bathroom, septic system. Eventually, it'll have running water. It's wired for power. Everything done in 10 months. In the northern part of Ghana is pretty astounding, you know, type thing. So, like I said, that's just part of, there's a time to relieve, and there's, even though you're in development mode, there's a time to stay in development mode. Pastor Paul, again, critical link, as you would be. And like I said, he serves in a lot of administrative function. He's a full-time pastor first. But part of the thing that I work with him on, and I'm going to share this with you in particular, but especially for the other guys, whatever we're able to do to help you, what we don't want to do, we do not want to distract from the pastoral side, the witnessing side, because even though he's the administrator, he administrates, he keeps the literacy program going. He makes sure the microfinance program is operating properly. He makes sure numbers of things are all happening within the community and stuff. But the real primary focus is to have him stay on top of his ministry. Okay? So just make sure you have got to tell us, tell Dusty, if you see that there's some piece of anything we're trying to help you with is pulling away or creating a distraction, it just means we have to bring help a different way. The help is going to be right there at your fingertips. You just may not be accessing it. So that's a valuable conversation for you guys to have. Hey, CY, or is this pulling down on your ability to run your own business? Is it pulling down on your ability to administer? We can't lose sight of that, okay? Very important. Something that's unique out up there in Wa in the last few years, The government of Ghana decided they wanted to grow their university system. So they looked at the four quadrants in the south and the north. In each corner, they said, we're going to put up a university. And basically, it's University of Developmental Studies. But in Wa, this facility is probably 150 to 200 acres, houses 16,000 students. And in Ghana, what they do is Ghana will help subsidize the education, higher education for its students, but you have to basically commit to a year of service back to the government in some way, whether it's for community teaching or whatever you're going to do, and they'll help you fund this. So you may have, but they tell the students where they're going to go to school, so you may well have students that live in southern Ghana going to Northwest because they've got openings in their curriculum to handle whatever they think you're going to specialize. So they kind of tell you where you're going to go, but they'll help you with it. So part of the thing you'll see in some of this presentation, and I'm looking for a way because in 5-10 years, I'll be at a point I won't even probably be physically able to do what I'm doing now. Okay? So I know it right now it takes about $40,000 a year to keep that literacy program running in its condition, okay? And the literacy program does other work besides just literacy. For example, all those pastors and fellowships in those churches, they actually also helped orchestrate it. And because poverty is so hard there, they keep a pastor's fund, and most of those pastors actually live off of somewhere between $5 to $10 a month. So they try to help keep those pastors stabilized in those rural villages. That's one. They also have a widow's fund because in northern Ghana, and it may be the same in Nigeria. I'm not sure. But the custom is a woman who may be, let's say there's two brothers. One brother's got a wife, other brother's got a wife. One brother and his wife are Christian family. The brother dies. Well, say his other brother is a Muslim. In their culture, it's required for the other brother to take in the wife of his brother, and she now becomes his wife. So now you have a Christian woman being forced into a Muslim environment, which, and plus, it's polygamy, which is totally against her entire religious beliefs. Well, in their village, if she does not agree to that, because it's their 1,000-year custom, she's ostracized and forced out. She'll have no home. So we have a widow's fund built into the literacy program that if we find that scenario exists, then we have the ability to go in and help get a home, a hut built, as well as create a financial sustainment until that lady can either move through into a micro-business role or some way of helping herself or an even extended support. I mean, you're talking, again, $5, $10 a month. It doesn't take a lot. But if you get 10, 12 of those running, it adds up to dollars. So that's even part of what goes on in this thing, okay? But these students is a huge ministry because what I begin to look at, we pour a tremendous amount also out of the literacy program in the North in funding for children. Again, the education is provided, but if they don't have uniforms, they don't have a way to get to school, it's there, but you can't get from this village to here. So again, part of this whole literacy program sustains keeping children and getting children into school as soon as we can, too. Well, we know.
In terms of transportation?
We help with transportation. We help with actually boarding costs. We help with uniforms, school books, all the things. There's any number of things that can affect a child being able to get an education there. So we felt like we were making an impact on educating the youngest. And of course, they're growing on through this. That's fine. But we begin to look at these college kids who said, you know what? In 4 years, a freshman coming in 4 years, this person's going to go back to their village, going to go back to their community. They're going to be the future politicians, the doctors, the lawyers, whatever they're going to do. If we could create an impact on a ministry to those students at this college, then what do we do for the whole of the country if all of a sudden we have some sort of impact on them? So that's another ministry that we're trying to develop now as part of this. And because of all the service needs that these students have, in need of places to eat, in need of copy services, in need of cafe, in need of book center, all those things, we're working on a program to create micro-businesses that will support these students. Therefore, we can create a relationship with the students in ministry as well as create a micro-business model all at the same time. That's being worked on now.
Would that be something within the vicinity of the campus or on campus? I mean,
oh, yeah. I'm fixing to show you here. Okay. There's a whole thing about this that what's interesting, this property, and then you look at, well, what's that, Gary? We've been able, again, as I came back, while I was there, Pastor Paul, he said, Gary, he said, I own a 100-by-100 lot. I bought it years and years ago, thought one of my kids might need it, but it's across the street from this university. And, you know, over in the West Africa and South America, it's tradition where, like, we have hotels or efficiency apartments. You guys use hostels. People yes. rent them. Well, when they built this university for these students, they only built 3 dormitories. There is nowhere close to enough living space for all these students. So these students are scattered out all over the community, and they're building hostels, and they're living in hostels and all this kind of stuff. So Pastor Paul came to me, and he said, you know, Gary, he said, I'd give this piece of property if we could build a small hostel. Because he said it's twofold. One, he said, I've got pastors from southern Ghana calling me, worried about their daughter being all the way up here. Mm-hmm. They don't know where they're living. They don't know what's going on, and they're concerned about the arrangement. He said, I feel like if I could take and provide some sort of housing for them, they could pay rent, then we could use that money to sustain the facility and maybe help offset the cost of literacy. So I'm thinking, not a bad idea. Unfortunately, a 100-by-100 lot just isn't big enough to sustain itself with a septic system and a well and all that kind of stuff. I said, what we need is more property. I said, how about look, see if you can find any? Well, sure enough, about 2 months later, I get a call from him. It's Brother Gary. He said, on the same side of the road adjacent to the university, there's 6 lots for sale. I said, how much money we need? So he says, probably going to be between $8,000 to $9,000. So I said, I'll call you back in 30 minutes. Jumped on the phone, made a call back to our pastor, talked to another member of our church, and I said, $10,000 is being wired today. Buy it. So I said, kind of keep an eye out in case any more comes up, especially if we connect to what we have now. Well, sure enough, he's taken and work on through this, and about a month later, I get a call. He said, Brother Gary, he said, 3 more lots adjacent to our lots up for sale. I said, how much you need? He said, probably about $4,000. Said, money's on the way. Buy it. So I go back over on another trip, and in the meantime, I had been approached by a big medical foundation that was wanting to do some medical work in Ghana, and they were looking for a place to anchor onto that already had an existing work of some type, so they just weren't starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. So I went back over and I said, we really need more property because if this medical thing develops, we may need more space in order to be able to rent them space for what they're trying to do. So I said, what's the chance of us getting 4 lots on the backside, 3 lots on the other, add 7 more, and that'll get us to 4.5 acres, which is a pretty sizable tract of land. So he says, I don't know, I'll check. So he calls me up, and he said, we can buy it. I said, how much money is it going to take? He got to forget what it was. Now I think it's about $16,000, $17,000. So I contacted some people. They said, Gary, buy it. So now this little piece you see is 4.5 acres of land that's to be developed, you know, for a new literacy center, for these micro businesses, hostels. So again, that thing would not only self-support itself, but it'd have a chance way past my lifetime to fund the literacy program. So again, it goes back to that whole thing we talked about, dreams,
yeah,
and a goal and an action plan. This is what that lot looks like today. They cleared it. I didn't tell them to do it. They planted it. They're sustaining a lot of the widows. This food that grows here sustains a whole network of people now. And that wasn't even on my radar. But what they did is they took the some of the microfinance funding. One of the local villagers, very good guy, came to me and said, you know what? If we could use this property and I could get enough funding to seed it and do it and get it cleared, we can do it. And sure enough, it's turning on itself, and that was just a benefit. Was never crossed my mind.
Was that corn?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Corn, and there's another type of cassava or something else, yeah, that they grow. Type,
yeah, thing. They don't like to have their land idle.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
Something, absolutely, can be done to it.
Absolutely. And I'm going to break here because it's an interesting story about this gentleman, because we're almost at 11:30, and then I'll follow up, because again, I think it's very important for you to understand there are going to be things that are going to come out of all of this that's the furthest thing you ever had in your mind. Okay? And this will break us into this story.